Welcome to Two Way Street. Today we're going to talk with two artists whose work has been heavily influenced by their experiences of living in the South, but who have a base of fans far beyond Georgia, the state they call home. When she was a little girl in the early 1940s, Beverly Watkins lived in a community of sharecroppers in what was then rural Commerce, Georgia. Her family and friends celebrated the end of harvest with barn dances at which her grandfather played his banjo, accompanied by one neighbor on a washboard, another on the fiddle. It wasn't long before she picked up her first guitar and began playing the blues. At age 77, she's still playing. You'll hear our conversation with Beverly Watkins and more of her music, too, later in the show. But first, we're going to talk with novelist, playwright, folklorist, and as if that isn't enough, composer Philip DePoy. DePoy's been part of the Atlanta art scene since the mid-1960s. He's a crazily prolific writer, with 18 novels and more than a dozen plays to his credit so far. He also writes and orchestrates music for his theatrical productions. DePoy uses Georgia as a location for many of his books and plays. He loves to write serial novels, mostly featuring his various detective heroes like Fever Devlin and Flap Tucker. He's got not just one, but two new novels that have just been published. They introduce two new detectives. Prisoner of Malta features the playwright and poet Christopher Marlowe as the Private Dick. Cold Florida is the first in a series of books based around Foggy Moskowitz, a Jewish car thief from Brooklyn who ends up investigating child abuse for the Florida Child Protective Services Agency. Philip DePoy, welcome to Two Way Street.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
The AJC, in an article some time ago, described you as a polymath. I had to look it up to make sure I knew what that word meant. What is a polymath?
It's a completely false term. I'm no good at math at all. Yeah, I mean, it used to be, the phrase used to be Renaissance person, but polymath is a hipper term currently.
Yeah, polymath is somebody who basically has knowledge about many, many different and diverse areas.
Or you could say a polymath is a person who is a jack of all trades and master of none.
Well, here's what you said. I'm often accused of not being able to stick to any one thing. Kind of a Renaissance man.
Well, it's true that I find everything interesting. I'm serious. I find cooking interesting. I find gardening interesting. I find every person I've ever met is interesting to me. So I'm easily distracted. I think that's probably the truest way to put it. I just have a lot of diverse interests.
You have a fascinating background. Your mother sang on the radio, is that right?
She did. She was. She had braces on her arms and legs because of polio. She had polio at the time, and they used to, her uncles had a 15-minute show on the radio in the 30s, and they used to sit her up on a stool because she couldn't reach the microphone. And the announcement would be, and now here's Barbara Hoy, the little cripple girl, to sing your gospel favorites.
Wow, where was this?
Illinois.
What songs did she sing?
She would, one of her favorites was a song called In the Garden, I Come to the Garden Alone While the Dew is Still on the Roses. And her uncles would join her in harmony. She was not an especially religious person. They just thought it was more heart-wrenching for a little cripple girl to sing gospel songs. Yeah.
And your father left Illinois to come to Atlanta. He was a French horn player and worked in the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra.
He did. That's why we came to Atlanta. I was about five. My brother was three. And my father was a French horn player in the original Atlanta Symphony. It was directed by Henry Sopkin. And at that time, it was a part-time gig. Right. You know, it wasn't a full-time opera thing at all, or a orchestra thing at all, although they played for the opera too. They would perform at the Civic Center, which was then that building that now belongs to Georgia State. That was a gigantic old building.
Building at Piedmont.
That's right.
Ralph McGill.
That's exactly it. And they would have everything there. So one night there would be the Harlem Globetrotters. The next night would be the Shrine Circus. And the next night would be the orchestra.
Your dad.
Yes, my dad played
Mozart.
You know, sweeping up after the elephants and playing Mozart. That's right. Exactly.
Do you remember seeing him perform when you were a little boy?
God, yeah. He would occasionally let us come to rehearsals with him. And it was a just great thrill, partly because I loved the music. I was a big classical fan even then as a kid, partly because you really could smell the place. You know, it smelled like elephants and basketball players. And this guy, Henry Sopkin, who was the original conductor, was a real character. They had some of the opera singers, they were performing, I think they were doing Candide, and he was screaming at the top of his lungs at the French horn players to play louder, and he finally said, play louder, I can still hear the singers.
When did you start playing music, and what was the first instrument of choice for you?
I started playing the guitar when I was 15. Somebody gave me a guitar that had two strings missing. And I learned to play on the four-string guitar for a while until I finally got the other strings. And I started writing music right then because I was in a group, this is mid-60s, called the Actors and Writers Workshop that was run by Walter and Betty Roberts, the parents of Eric Roberts and Julia Roberts. I just happened to be playing the guitar there one day, and Rob, the father, the guy that ran the place, really asked me if I would write music for one of the Shakespeare plays that we were doing. We were doing, I think, As You Like It. I said, sure. So I wrote three songs for that, and he then asked me from then on to write music for all the shows.
Do you remember any of the songs, how they went?
Let's see. I wrote music for O Mistress Mine, and I kind of remember that.
Sing a little of it for us.
Well, this will be terrible, but it was, oh, mistress mine, where are you going?
Very nice.
Yeah.
I don't want to move.
15.
Yeah, well, but wait a minute. There is a really interesting story about your time with this theater group. Not only was it run by Julia and Eric Roberts' parents, but Yolanda King was a part of the group.
She was indeed. In fact, Coretta King was a big supporter financially of the group.
And so you did scene work, I guess, or maybe plays with Yolanda, who of course is MLK's daughter, one of the kids.
Yeah.
I understand there was an incident in a play where you kissed Yolanda
you know
King.
How do you know
and
about
caused
this?
Controversy that brought the Klan into the picture.
It's true. It's a bizarre story, but yes, we were doing Rob had written scripts for some Uncle Remus stories, some Joel Chandler Harris stories. So there we were on a flatbed truck at, I think it was Carver Homes, one of the old housing projects in Atlanta. And a flatbed truck, and I was dressed as a fox, and Yolanda was dressed as a turtle. She was the Brer Terrapin, or Sister Terrapin. And she came up with a good idea for me to catch Brer Rabbit, and so I kissed her on the cheek. And when I did, the crowd went nuts, you know. It was people just yelling and screaming and laughing, mostly. But there were a couple of people there would come because we were a desegregated acting troupe in 1965 or 66. And one of these guys was so upset by that kiss that he came back the next day, because we were there 3 days in a row, and had a bomb that he was going to set off. And he did. He set off the bomb, but he was so drunk and so dim that he set it off close to his car, and it actually blew his car up, his own car, Buick, up, and it caught on fire. and he didn't know what to do, and he stayed there to try to put the fire out, and so the cops came and arrested him while he was still trying to put the fire that he'd started out.
In his own car.
In his own car. So this is the mentality of the people that were protesting against us.
I mean, it was a double whammy. I mean, it was bad enough that a young white teenager kissed a black girl on the cheek, but I mean, this was also cross species.
It was interspecies. That's right. Fox and terrapin. It's actually more offensive, I think, to this guy. And Yolanda and I, we just so dug the fact that this got people crazy. That I don't think it would be untoward for me to say that Yolanda and I practiced that kiss a bit
off stage.
Yeah, off stage. Yeah.
Did you know Dr. King? Did he come see any of those performances?
Coretta came more often, but yes, all of us got to go over to the King household once to have dinner with them all. You know, it's just so starstruck to meet Dr. King and to see the family, and the kids were misbehaving, you know, and it was kind of loud. And Dr. King, his whole thing was asking us about the show, you know, rather than talking about his work or what he was doing or himself at all. I was just completely disarmed by the fact that he was asking my brother about, or somebody about this part in the show that had nothing to do with his kids or anything. It was just wonderful. It was just like going over to another family's house.
You went to Georgia State University and you studied folklore. Is that right?
That's right. Mostly the gateway drug for that was folk music, was true folk music, Appalachian music and British Isles music that came to Appalachia.
Yeah, what we often now call roots music.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes it's called that, very often called that, or Celtic music that got transplanted to the United States. A lot of the songs are similar from the Appalachian version of Barbara Allen is a whole lot like the traditional British Isles version of Barbara Allen.
I want to talk about that. I'm glad you brought up Barbara Allen.
Okay, cool.
Because you collected the music of North Georgia Mountains.
I did.
You were sort of the Alan Lomax of North Georgia.
Me and about 50 other guys.
Okay, fine. But you actually have described how Barbara Allen changed from when it came to this state, when it came to Georgia, I assume through Great Britain, down to the coast, right?
That's exactly right.
And it made its way up to the Appalachian folks in North Georgia.
That's right.
And you say there was a distinct difference in how that song was performed.
Oh, gosh, yeah. The British Isles version eventually got translated into an almost chamber piece. It was a very acceptable song to sing in parlors and that sort of thing in the 1700s, late 1600s, early 1700s.
So how would that have sounded?
That's the, it was in the time of Martinmas when green buds they were swelling, that Sir John Graham from the West Country fell in love with Barbara Allen. That's it. That's the melody. So it comes across the ocean, hits the shores, migrates up the mountain to North Georgia and to places like that. And 50 years later, it's all in the very month of May, when green buds they were swelling, you know, and it goes like that. So it's more nasal, not nearly as melodic or tame, you know, and it's a tough. In the original one, you know, it's sort of a gentle thing that Barbara Allen says, I think you're dying. In the Appalachian version, when she says, young man, I think you're dying, you can tell that she's happy. She's glad that he dead you, rascal you, you know. So it was a terrific change. And often a lot of people say it reflects the, you know, just genuine hardship of Appalachia, especially in the 1800s and all the way through the Depression.
In Scarlet Town, when I was born, there was a fair dwelling, made every youth cry well again. Her name was Barbara Allen. All in the
If you're just joining us, my guest is Atlanta-based novelist, playwright, and composer Philip DePoy. After a short break, we'll talk about his two new novels, detective stories that couldn't be less similar in locale, time period, and the identity of the protagonists.
All in the merry month of May, when the green buds they were swelling, young William Green on his deathbed lay for the love of Barbara.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. I'm talking to Philip DePoy. He's a Decatur-based novelist, playwright, and composer who uses Georgia as a setting for many of his works. Let's talk about current work, okay?
Thank you.
You have really two new books. One of them was Prisoner of Malta. Who's your protagonist?
Christopher Marlowe is the main guy in this. He's, you know, a contemporary of Shakespeare, a playwright, poet, swordsman, brawler, bon vivant, you know, a really fascinating character that almost everybody nowadays thinks was also a spy for Queen Elizabeth.
And in fact, that's an important part of what
that
of the
figures
story.
Into A Prisoner in Malta. And the title is a sort of in-joke because one of Marlowe's big plays is called The Jew of Malta, mm-hmm. and has to do with the island of Malta and a couple of other things like that. And one of the other main characters in the book, his best friend, is Dr. Rodrigo Lopez, another historical figure who was a Portuguese Jew who had some dealings with the Jews on the island of Malta and was Queen Elizabeth's main physician, saved her life a number of times.
And in the story, Marlowe is called upon to unravel what appears to be a plot to assassinate Elizabeth I.
Yeah, there's a lot of juicy territory there for this. This hopes to be a long and, you know, prosperous series. There were, all told, in my research, 23 formal almost succeeded plots against Queen Elizabeth.
Wow.
To assassinate her.
Wow.
And many more attempts that were just sort of weak that never came to fruition. But 23 times it almost happened that Queen Elizabeth was killed. So that's at least 23 books right there.
You also say that Marlowe was a fencing master.
Yeah. He was almost as notorious for his brawls in pubs and in
which
the streets.
Which is how he died.
It is how he died. And, he was very famous for fighting. He fought a special way of fighting that was developed partially in France but mostly in England with rapier and dagger. You have your rapier in one hand and dagger in another. And the whole idea is to mess with the person with the rapier just so you can get close enough to stick them with the dagger.
You say that in comparing yourself to Marlowe, the similarities, while he was a fencing master, you actually took two fencing classes and learned the difference between a parry and a plié.
Yeah.
Except, as I think we both know, Philip, a plié is a ballet term, not a fencing
term. Oh, that's
right. The other thing that you love about Christopher Marlowe is his poetry. Oh. And you say that the poem that really moves you deeply is a love poem. What is it?
Well, that's his famous poem of seduction, Come Live With Me and Be My Love, and We Shall All the Pleasures Prove of blah, 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 you know.
And we will all the pleasures prove that valleys, groves, hills and fields, woods or steepy mountain yields.
Yes, and it's a great... Won't you just come? Listen, let's abandon the world. Come and live with me. We'll live under the bower. We'll sleep in the straw. I'll give you a garland of flowers if you'll just come over here and, you know, get next to me. And, it apparently worked a lot.
Now, you have an even newer book.
Yes.
Which is?
It's called Cold Florida. It's set in the 70s in fictitious... a place called Fry's Bay, Florida. And the hero is a guy that has just started to work for the recently formed Child Protective Services.
He's a Jewish car thief from Brooklyn.
He is. His name is Foggy Moskowitz. And he's a character right out of Damon Runyon, you know, of whom I'm a gigantic fan. In fact, the first version of this book I wrote in, I'm trying to start suddenly, I'm talking like Damon Runyon. I wrote in a Damon Runyon style, that is, everything was in present tense. In all of his novels, Damon Runyon wrote his characters in present tense. So the first sentence is often, "So I am in Mindy's one night when in walks Harry the horse." And I wrote it like that, and the editor said, "Just cut it out, go back, write it like a real book." Yeah.
Take Guys and Dolls off the record player.
That's right. Apple Annie, any of those, right. Just get rid of them all and start over again, which I did. And the character's great fun to write because he's sort of, it's been compared to a couple of my favorite authors, you know, Elmore,
Leonard,
yeah. And it has been compared to Damon Runyon, so I must be doing something right with the guy. But he's really a lot of fun to write, and it's so different from the Marlowe character. You know, Marlowe is quasi-Elizabethan speak, although it's much more modernized than that. And Foggy Moskowitz is gangster, hoodlum, 70s, tough guy type.
As if all this isn't enough, you are working on a commission for the Alliance Theater called Nick's Flamingo Grill.
Yes.
Which is based on a true story about a nightclub in Atlanta in the 50s, right?
This was a club. It was in what's now called Castleberry Heights Hills.
Castleberry Hill.
Yeah, yeah. That neighborhood over
down
by the Armour.
Just south of downtown.
Right, exactly. Right. And there was an Armour meatpacking plant kind of close by, which I think is now Lofts or something bizarre. But it was opened in, I think, maybe 56 or 58 by two guys who had become pals during World War II. This much is true. One was a black guy who had gone to, if I'm not mistaken, he had gone to Yale and then gotten drafted. So there was that. And the other guy that started was a guy whose father was a cantor at the temple on Peachtree.
Yeah.
And they just got to be friends during World War II and lived in Paris for a number of years. And in Paris, they, you know, dated who they wanted to, and they were best pals, and nothing was wrong. And they went, well, this is it. Racism is over. We're good. Let's go back to Atlanta and start a nightclub. So they came back to Atlanta in the late 50s and discovered that racism wasn't maybe over entirely by, 1958. So the club lasted, I think, in real life about 3 months.
Really?
Yeah. And the African-American guy went back to Paris and played there for the rest of his life. And the Caucasian guy, or the Jewish guy, ended up being one of the original musical directors for certain work that Martin Luther King was doing.
Wow.
In the late 50s.
It's going to be a musical.
Yeah.
You, in a conversation you had, a published conversation, were asked to connect Nick's Flamingo Bar and Grill to the Black Lives Matter movement, and you found a connection. What is it?
Well, it's a tough one, you know, but I mean, to me, the lesson of that little club that really thought, well, this is it, we're done, and then got the smackdown from the Klan and from the city bureaucracy and everybody else so sharply that they just had to close. But it didn't stop there, you know. The difference between an idea maybe in a movement is the movement doesn't stop. I had the same sensation. I wish, I'm sort of heartbroken to report this to you, Bill, and maybe you had something like this when you were younger, too. In 1968, I was positive that because of what I was doing and my friends were doing in what we referred to as the movement then, we're going to end racism, sexism, and poverty by 1972, roughly. So imagine how disheartened we were that, you know, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all these people we thought were going to help got killed. And, Nixon was elected president. So that was it. Once again, you get the smackdown. Well, all you have to do is not stop. All you have to do is keep on walking, right? And so the rebirth of that now is, I think, among other things, the Black Lives Matter. And it's a continuation of stuff that started probably, I don't know, in Egypt 5,000 years ago.
Yeah. I want to, if you don't mind, ask you a question that it's a theme that recurs on this show for me. I've talked to a lot of people about it. You, like I am, are a transplant from the North, although you came here when you were really
young. Quite young, yeah.
I came from Chicago when I was already an adult and working in journalism. You came when you were much younger. But like a lot of people, and you deal with it in some of your work, so you fell in love with folklore, and certainly the folklore of Georgia and the South. Me too.
Yeah.
But I continue to have a very difficult time reconciling the dark history of our state, of the South, with the culture that is so rich and so wonderful, the music, the literature, the food.
Yeah.
How do you put those things together in your head?
You know, you really hit on something that's really tough for me and has been tough for a long time. Because of the way my parents were and because of my upbringing, I just kind of assumed everybody was everybody, you know, so that when our high school, for example, around this same time in the mid-60s was desegregated, it didn't seem like that big a deal to me at first. I didn't think there was going to be that much
trouble. What high school?
Trouble. Southwest High School, over on the southwest side of town, sort of close to Greenbrier Mall now. You know, so I was pals with pretty much everybody, and I dated a girl of color for a minute, and we had a cross burned in our yard because of my brother and I had friends from all walks of life or whatever, however now you say it. And we had a cross burned in our front yard, and it just was stunning to me that people who were yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, and here's some cornbread that I made for you because you got sick, and let me hold the door for you, and all that stuff. Those same people were burn a cross in your yard, yell horrible words at you. I mean, it's like a Jekyll and Hyde thing almost that you get from certain Southern culture, because I had this exact experience collecting folklore. People, I would go and I would set down the old woolen sack, and they would tell these great stories filled with love and compassion and, you know, the partially born of religion, and then tell the worst, meanest, racist jokes that I just actually had to turn off the tape recorder. And it's been always hard for me to reconcile those two things about the world, but certainly my experiences in the South. And trying to find what is the common denominator of all that has proved so far for me elusive. I don't understand how someone who claims to be, say, a good Christian, whose message is love and compassion, can at the same time talk about making sure that people don't get into this neighborhood. And it's something that has baffled me my entire life as I continue to search for my own spiritual understanding of what the world is and what my religious or spiritual philosophy is, which I'm still kind of puzzled about and thinking about and worrying about. I have finally come to this conclusion. I have to do what I do. I have to be the person that the best, you know, who is it that said this? I mean, Jung said it a certain way. Your main job in life is to find out exactly who and what you are and be that. Mm. And it's much easier said than done. Much easier said than done. But once you start doing that as best you can, you become a sort of battery or energy source or life source for the other light in the universe, for the other positive, loving element of the universe. So you contribute to that just the way, you know, a drop of water contributes to the ocean. It's a little drop, but it makes the ocean a little bigger.
It occurs to me as I hear you say that, that it is that impulse of yours that probably helps energize the vast and varied work that you do as a novelist, as a playwright, as a composer. That life force is animated by all that you do today.
I think that it is, because it all comes from the same source, whatever that is, and I have no idea what it is. But all of the impulse to write music or a play or a book or to cook a good meal or to, you know, dig up the ground, it all, that impulse is all the same impulse for me, and it comes from the same source. So, yes, I would say that's the thing, that's the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. It's what makes me want to do what I do, and it what makes me excited to do the things that I do and love.
Philip DePuy, thank you so much for being here for Two Way Street. It's really a pleasure to get to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together, try to love one another right now.
If you want to know more about Philip DePuy's new novels, The Prisoner of Malta and Cold Florida, or about the rest of his body of work, you'll find it on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, you'll hear from Beverly Guitar Watkins.
If you hear the song I sing, you will understand. Listen. You hold the key to love and fear, all in your trembling hand. Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your command. Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now.
Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. We're going to talk now with Atlanta blues legend Beverly Watkins. She got her professional start with another Georgia great, Piano Red, also known as Dr. Feelgood. Watkins played on a number of his hit records starting in the early 1960s. Over the years, she's played guitar with music icons like Ray Charles, James Brown, and B.B. King. Watkins celebrated her 77th birthday about a month ago, and she is still playing the blues. We started our conversation with Watkins by asking her about her earliest exposure to music, when she lived with her sharecropper grandparents in what was then rural Commerce, Georgia, in the 1940s.
Everyone around the vicinity there, they would come together and help each other, sharecropping, getting the crops ready before winter. And then after they do all of that, they would have a big party. They call it the barn dance back then. My granddaddy would take me to this event with him. And my Aunt Margaret, which is deceased now, she gave me a little old guitar called the Stella. I had no idea that that was a gift from God to me, you know, as playing the guitar.
So you were 8 years old. You got this little guitar as a gift. And then the blues. Yes.
And then here come the blues. And the first song I learned to play was Blue Suede Shoes.
Can you still play it?
Yes.
You have your guitar. Do you want to play a little of it for us?
I can.
All right, let's do it.
One for the money, two for the show, three make ready, let's go, cat, go now, don't step on my blue suede shoe. Yeah, you can do anything, step on my blue suede shoe. Knock my hat, break my shoes. I said, don't step on my blue suede shoe. I can tell you people don't step on my blue suede shoe. I said, blue suede shoe, blue suede shoes, blue suede shoes. Oh, you can do anything, don't step on my blue suede shoes. Oh, yeah.
Wow, Beverly Watkins' first song, Blue Suede Shoes. That wasn't Elvis's song at first, was it?
No, someone else wrote that.
Yeah.
Before Elvis.
Yeah, I thought so. And it was the blues that really captivated you. Why?
The blues, because I guess I was born with the blues in me.
What are some basic blues chords? I mean, there's a fairly simple and straightforward blues progression, right? That you
yes.
learn initially, which is what?
Yes, okay. Like I play in G7.
You want to show us while you're telling us?
Okay. All right. Can do.
Thank
I'm
you.
I'm going to do a slow blues.
Okay.
Blues chord, G7. That's a C7. Yeah.
Oh, I got the blues. I'm singing about the blues.
Yeah. Then you go to D. You know the blues. Well, blues is all right for you. I want to tell you people, I'm going to play the blues for you.
That's wonderful. So there you go.
Yes, after I finished high school, I went right as a senior, and I finished Archie. I went on the road playing rhythm guitar with Piano Red.
You were a bass player when you started, is that right?
Yes.
Why didn't that take?
Well, I say like this here. We all have gifts, and they don't come overnight. Whenever the Lord gets ready to reveal that gift to you, because back when I played with Piano Red as rhythm, I didn't sing. I didn't do any vocals. All I did was stand up there and look pretty and played rhythm.
But yeah. You were born, God made you to be a lead guitar player.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, you know, this is what he wanted me to do.
There are many people who think in some ways Piano Red really kind of led the way for rock and roll to develop. Because
yes.
of the way he played, right?
Yes, he did, with his style. Yes, sir.
Let's listen to the song that you performed on this record we're about to hear a little bit of.
Okay.
It was Piano Red, and it became one of the most famous songs that you all would perform, Mr. Moonlight.
Yes.
Mr. Yes. Moonlight. You came to me one summer night.
Yeah.
And from your feet,
who is that singing lead?
That's Roy Lee. And Curtis is,
and from the world,
that's Curtis doing the second part. It was three of us.
And from above, you brought
the world. Great song.
Wow.
The Beatles recorded that song, made it famous, yes?
Yes, they did.
Wow.
When we went and did Dr. Feelgood, Dr. Feelgood, that CD went platinum. And then that's when we start going out of the state.
What was one of the tracks on Dr. Feelgood that you remember that you particularly liked?
Oh, I liked Rice String Baby, but the wrong yo-yo. You know, I do that now.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because mm-hmm. that was one of Piano Red's signature songs, but it's kind of become a signature song for you. Would you share a little of it with us?
I sure will. Mm-hmm. Baby, for my yo-yo, somebody's knocking on your door. Pass by the store, put the string on wrong. A brand new string for my yo-yo. Hey, Mama told me, and Papa did too. Some of those men's gonna make a fool of you. Better find out which one you pray. Right string, baby, for my yo-yo.
You used to play that song with Piano Red, and I heard you play it on stage at Northside Tavern a couple weeks ago, where you were celebrating a big birthday.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm telling you, it's just amazing to be sitting here. I want to say this. I can see. I can use my hands. I can talk. I can hear. I can walk. I can put on my clothes. To be 77 years old, we had a great time.
It's good night. Good night. You did one of your signature moves. You played the guitar behind your head. We're going to post a video on our Two-Way Street website so people can watch you do that. Have you been doing that? Is that a trick you've been doing for many years now?
Well, yes, I have. You know, someone told me, say, how do you do? I said, that's God's gift. I have a cousin. I went to her house, and she had a little band set up, you know, on the weekend. And, of course, she don't play guitar, you know. Her name is Regina Choates. But anyway, she said, I put the guitar behind my head, and I had a cramp back.
I had to go to the orthopedic surgeon afterward.
Yeah.
You couldn't make a living as a musician, as an artist, for a long time, could you?
It was a long time, yes, it was.
How did you make your living when you were already playing with Piano Red and mm-hmm. out there doing really wonderful things? But how did you make your living?
Well, back in 78, 79, the band broke up. Our group broke up, and everybody went their ways. But I never stopped playing. What happened was, I got a job washing cars, but I played on the weekend here in Atlanta. What happened? I joined up with Mr. Eddie Tigner, which he is 90 years old now, one of the original Ink Spots.
Wow.
And I went out with him and played bass. We would go to like some of the big motels, Holiday Inns, and we probably would stay there probably a week, 2 weeks, you know, playing in the lounges. When I come back in town, then it rocked on. Then I got jobs cleaning houses. Then after that, then I start cleaning offices, but I never stopped playing.
You had a platinum album you talked about, but
yes.
But you didn't see much come your way as a result of that, did you?
No, I didn't.
What happened?
It was divided before it got to me, you know.
That must have hurt.
It really did. It really did. Now I'm getting a little royalties, but maybe not what I should get. But, you know, this is what I'm saying is God, he's keeping me here at 77 years old. What I didn't get back then, I'm still going to get.
It was in 1999 when your CD came out. Mm-hmm. It was that CD that put you back on the map. Isn't that right? The title of the CD was Back in Business. And yes. Here's the title track. I wanted to make sure we got a little bit of you playing that guitar. Back in Business.
Yes.
Do you remember that song?
Sure.
Why don't you play it? Would you mind playing a little live for us?
Back in business. Back in business. Well, I'm back in business. Well, I'm back in business. Well, I'm back in business. Jumping to the very end. Oh, yeah.
Beverly Watkins, Back in Business. What did that CD do for you in your career?
Oh, it carried me many places. It really did.
Where?
We went to Paris, France. We went to Germany, Argentina. I can just go on and go on, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it really brought me out, really did.
Could you start making a living as a blues artist at that point?
Yes.
That's good.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Here you are, just celebrated your 77th birthday.
Yes.
And you are still playing. You're at Northside Tavern pretty regularly. As you've said, you're at Blind Willie's with some regularity. Are you traveling at all?
Well, I have some dates coming up. And also, I go and play at the nursing homes myself and give it back.
Wow.
Got to give it back.
You want to play us out? What do you want to play? What's a favorite?
Maybe I will do this, gospel.
Oh, I love that idea.
This is about the Lord will make a way somehow. I know the Lord, he'll make a way. Yes, he will. I know the Lord, he'll make a way. Yes, he will. That's the truth, y'all. You can go to him in secret prayer. Yes, and I know that he can answer your prayer. I know the Lord, he'll make a way. Yes, he will. Yes, he will. Yes, he will. Yes, he will. I have a Savior. I can carry my troubles too. And I don't know what to do.
Beverly Watkins, it's been just a joy to have you here in the Two Way Street studio today. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Glad to be here.
We've posted a couple of videos of Beverly Watkins playing blues on the Two-Way Street website, gpb.org/TWS, and on our Facebook page. If you want to see her perform live, Watkins continues to play at several Atlanta blues bars, Northside Tavern, Blind Willie's, and Fat Matt's Rib Shack. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Our producer is the totally terrific Jenny Ament. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.